Hi everyone, I'm Mark Esper. Welcome to our latest light-hearted roundtable roundup of recent movies over the last few months. Here we reassess what has already passed and decide whether they deserve reconsideration or regret for having been seen in the first place. That's because sometimes there are movies that can change your mind. Have a listen now.
Yes. Right, okay, cool. So, I reckon we start. Hey everyone, welcome to an as promised round the table discussion about recent films in the last quarter of 2022 and obviously looking ahead to the Oscars. We're joined with Alex Burlington from firstshowing.net and David Morricone from Ex Berliner. Hello guys.
Hello.
and I have to say, I like that we're literally at a table together.
Yes.
As so many podcasts are recorded at home in the confines of your own little corner, this is us literally at a table right now.
Indeed.
No one can see it, but I can feel it amongst us.
You poet. I mean, that was delightful. You.
So yeah, so we've managed to take over a small portion of a local cafe where we can talk about films and what's coming up. So just to sort of set the scene, I'm going to read through the smorgasbord of titles that have been seen and reviewed over the last quarter, and then we're going to open up the discussion to see which films are worth remembering and which ones aren't. So just to where you're at.
Just for those of you who can't see at home and who can only hear, Alex right now just gave me a lovely little smile, but the side eye of just going, I'm watching you, Morricone. I'm watching how
what
fucking...
What are you going to remember?
Yeah, exactly. How much are you going to piss in my porridge, David, kind of thing?
And no, I like my porridge. Not piss-free, please.
Yeah, exactly. Good.
As I say, all opinions and foul language are on the table. There are no restrictions.
Lovely.
Beautiful curse word you just dropped there. Lovely.
Okay, so in no order of preference, films that possibly we bring back from the dead or maybe we bury. The Matrix Resurrections, Operation Mincemeat, Power of the Dog, Spider-Man No Way Home, Brian and Charles, Come On, Come On, The Tragedy of Macbeth, Blue Bayou, Cyrano, Moonfall, Death on the Nile, King Richard, Marry Me, Big Bug, Belfast, Cop Shop, Studio 666, The Lost Daughter, Red Rocket, and then The Batman.
The Batman.
The Batman.
He will be the last vengeance of this list.
So, come on then, guys. Out of that list, who suffered?
Well, the one I would drop immediately is Moonfall.
Moonfall?
Because, okay. It's like already forgotten. In the, I guess... The process of enjoying it was, oh, it's a new Roland Emmerich movie. It's a new Roland Emmerich movie at which the moon crashes into the earth, which is what I want from a Roland Emmerich movie.
I loved Moonfall. I thought it was absolute bonkers, but it had the strength of its convictions. Like, it didn't fail. I mean, that last act, it genuinely, I was just like, this is nuts. It can't get any worse. My God, somebody, like, greenlit this script. At no point did somebody go over to Roland going, Roland, we need to talk about the practicalities of gravity and how that works.
Right,
And I love the fact that it was so absolutely fucking insane, and it just didn't disappoint. I mean, the most fun I've had in the cinema in a very long time.
I wish I felt the same way,
really?
David, because I don't hate it. I just think that, especially as a hardcore Independence Day nerd,
okay,
I like have always been waiting for Emmerich to get back to that, and I thought Moonfall would be that level. And you're right, it's like absurd in every possible way. But by the end, I wasn't like, and maybe I just had a bad experience watching it the one time I saw it. But by the end, I wasn't like, oh my God, like you, like I wanted to feel that way.
And
now, like a month or two later, I'm like,
it's nowhere near Independence Day. I fully agree with you that it's nowhere near up there, and it is, you know, just, and right, I'm not going to be thinking about it, but still, in the moment, I was just like, ah, oh, cinema.
But not to mire the conversation or give it an undue adjective, but I want to talk about the subtleties of Moonfall.
The what?
The who?
Subtleties.
Yeah, what
do
you refer to?
What's in your hot chocolate? What have you been drinking?
You refer to how many craters are on the moon? What are you talking about here?
No, I mean, the thing that's interesting about this is it's not as American-centric as some of his other films have been. It's actually quite a pluralist disaster movie. And he's managed to sneak this under the wire, and I was like, well, that's pretty clever.
Maybe. I would say Wandering Earth, the Chinese one, is more anti-America than anything I've ever seen. Like, yeah, a disaster movie where they make fun of the Americans is not as common as, I think, Moonfall, which is mostly set in America, about Americans.
But this is where the subtlety is, because it's not waving that flag saying, we're coming to get you. He's just kind of snuck it under the table, and nobody realized, we're watching a bunch of Europeans and Asian folk trying to sort things out.
I see what you mean, but I think you're... I mean, I admire the fact that you're actually giving it that much thought. I mean, this is a film which genuinely, and I don't know about all of you, but I came out of that film and for the week afterwards was essentially singing Skyfall by Adele, but with the moon, let the moon fall. And it, glorious bit of entertainment.
Okay, so which other one has fallen from grace? What other name on that list just leapt out?
The first one, Matrix Resurrections. I mean, like, I have to admit, I'm surprised by how... I mean, you know, there was conversation at the time, but because of the time in which it was released, like, towards the end of the year, it was just kind of... It felt a little bit unceremoniously dumped at the end of the year. And quite frankly, and I know that it hasn't done great box office numbers, it's been a disappointment, but that's one that I haven't thought about. And hence, I thought there would be a little bit more like, oh, yeah, okay, I see. I haven't even revisited it.
I have revisited it. I've rewatched it, and I find it similar to my first appreciation of Skyfall, which I hated on first screening.
Okay.
And yet, when I watched the second time, and I kind of relaxed and let go of that expectation of please be better than this, this, or this, I actually could really enjoy it.
All right.
I think again, the other thing is, there needs to be this kind of mental separation. I had this conversation with a friend of mine about the Solo movie, the Star Wars movie. Whereas, like, if you let go of Harrison Ford, you can enjoy Solo. It's actually an enjoyable film. In the same way that if you can let go of Matrix 1 and just accept that this is a kind of, how can I put it, self-referential homage, then you can enjoy it. Right. Rather than expecting it to be another CGI benchmark bullet fest.
But didn't you... I mean, like, I hear what you're saying about the self-referential stuff. I mean, that stuff came up as unbearably smug to me during that film, much in the same way that films like... We've also had Scream as well, which is by its very nature and the fabric of the franchise, very self-referential and meta. And I thought this had an interesting kind of approach to it, but after a while I was just like, if you're not going to kind of counterbalance that with some really decent action... I was very underwhelmed by the action in that film and just thought, wow, you have half a good film, and then the rest I was just a bit bored.
It's hard to... I think that's its biggest failure. It's like, I don't know anyone that truly thought its action was amazing. I do think the interesting thing that is actually really sad to me is that I agree with you in your judgment, and that the conversation about it has just immediately stopped. Yes. It almost immediately stopped like a week after it came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I still think there's a lot to discuss, but I don't know why, other than the fact that it didn't excite people the way they expected it to, I don't know why the conversation just died so quickly. And you say it was dumped in December, which it kind of was, but at the same time, it's like, when would it have been better to open it to have a better conversation? Yeah. Because every week now, you open something and then, you know, either something in the world happens or something else happens, or the next film comes up and takes away from it. And I think personally, I would discuss Matrix more, but I do agree that it's like, it didn't blow me away. It wasn't on my top 10. It didn't. And of course, I wanted it to be all of these things, and it wasn't. But that doesn't mean I still could find something worthwhile to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think, like many of the Wachowski films, they will be... Actually, I think we're almost too early talking about it, because I think in years it may be revisited and kind of re-examined and thought about. Much like Speed Racer, where some people still hate Speed Racer, but some people, many, like a decade now, have come back to it.
Well,
and
it's
like,
had a reappraisal. Hey,
yeah,
just
exactly.
Like, you know, much in the same way we're finding, like, Miami Vice at the moment is, like, constantly being, like, you know, touted as this absolute misunderstood masterpiece.
Yeah.
But no, I agree, and it is... definitely an interesting film, and one that I will watch again at some point. But I was just very, very surprised by... I mean, I didn't have that high expectations on it, but just very underwhelmed.
Well, the other one that I would willingly toss into the furnace of obscurity is Jean-Pierre Jeunet's A Big Buck.
Did you see it, David?
I haven't seen it.
Oh.
I don't want to say you don't need to, but you don't need
Because I have to admit, I'm a fan of Jean-Pierre Jeunet. Yeah. I do like his stuff in general. I can't remember the last time I've seen a film by him that completely blew me away. So what's this one even about?
It's like in the distant future where like your whole home is managed by these robots, but they're like, it's Jeunet level goofy.
Okay.
Like there's like an Einstein robot, and the main bad guy is super weird and.
You know like how sort of a lot of French sex comedies revolve around the parents shagging, the kids shagging, everybody shagging.
Maybe I should. What else do you need, my God? What is the problem here? I mean, we have given the world the Ménage à Trois. Of course, we put it on film.
So it's going for the central joke that essentially this French family and their neighbors and their friends are so self-preoccupied that the world is going to bits around them, and yet they're still turning on themselves. Mm. Which is a fun joke, but not for the length of time that it goes on for.
Really?
No, unfortunately not.
Interesting, because that completely passed me by. So, okay, good to know.
But I think that's it fits in that position. Like, I watched I only watched three quarters of it because I just like kept getting bored.
I did the whole and I was like, thing.
I was like, what? Yeah, what else is it going? But I think it was also there are these films which it's hard to analyze this until you've seen it, because in the film critic world, that's always the most important thing. But there are films where I feel like there's a reason that it was quietly released on Netflix with no attention, no pizzazz, even though it's Jeunet. Like, he's the kind of filmmaker that should have had a big marketing campaign,
absolutely.
The return of, you know, but it was like the ultimate Netflix, oh, here we go, it's just on our service thing. And I hate to analyze it this way, but it's true. It's like, there's a reason, which is that it's just not a good film.
Yeah.
And I think the sad thing is that if you dig deeper into the analysis, you're like, is that because Netflix didn't properly produce it? Or is it because Jeunet has just lost his touch? And the film that he ended up making is not something that they were very proud of, even though they said, hey, we'll give you the money to do it. I don't know.
I think they watched it, and then they realized.
Right, but you have to ask, like, how does production work in the pre-Netflix days? Does his script go through more passes before it even gets made? Therefore, by the time he makes it, it actually turns out to be a better film?
Mm.
Or is in the Netflix, like, this is a common problem I hear from the Netflix era, is that Netflix is so hands-off that you get such, you know, quote-unquote personal films from these filmmakers that just aren't good. And the question is,
right,
why?
Because they're not reined in.
And
the thing is that someone like Jeunet, and I'd put also Michel Gondry, since we're talking about French filmmakers, that they have such a distinctive style. That and I'd also put Tarantino in this as well. It's just one of those things where you're just like, no, you need an editor. You need somebody to just go, you're being overindulgent here. We love your kookiness. We love your style. We love your tropes. But, you know, just rein it in, because otherwise it feels a little bit, well, masturbatory, really. And yeah, and from the sounds of it, this new Jeunet sounds a little bit like
that. It's a lot of Netflix films have like good crazy ideas that just don't work at all, and this is the epitome of that. You're like, okay, kind of a cool idea, robots taking over or something, like also colorful and kooky and futuristic, but has nothing to offer beyond that.
No. But just coming back to that point you raised about Netflix, how can I put it? The example of where that philosophy works is The Lost Daughter, which is a film that by its very subject would probably struggle to raise finance and struggle with production. And yet, for my take, and here we go, first controversial posit of the podcast, I think it's substantially better than Power of a Dog or Power of the Dog.
I mean, and I think people are agreeing. I mean, it recently won quite a few at the
Spirit.
Yeah, the Spirit Awards. Yeah, and I'm thrilled because I love The Lost Daughter.
Yeah,
I think and
this is one we can all agree on.
Right, and also it did that thing which I think any good film, and like The Power of the Dog, because it's adapted by a book.
Yeah.
I went off and bought the book.
Yeah.
And read it afterwards, because I like Elena Ferrante enormously. I've read several of her books, but that one was not one of them. And I think especially, and I know that, you know, those kind of conversations don't necessarily, like, you know, should necessarily enter how much you enjoyed a film, but as a first-time filmmaker, and what she does, what Maggie Gyllenhaal does with that film, I think is superb, and I couldn't be more thrilled that is getting a lot of appreciation. And maybe, and we can talk about this when we go on to the Oscars, that I hope it wins something, because it is one of those films. And again, like you say, with regards to Netflix, I mean, I can see the power of the dog potentially winning big, but I think one of the great casualties might be the Lost Daughter, because I think in any other year it deserved to be a frontrunner.
Because that's the crazy thing, they're both coming out of the same stable, both Netflix productions, but clearly, you know, one has developed more column inches on the internet and in newspapers than the other. I mean, I watched the film and my jaw just pretty much stayed open the whole time, because Jessie Buckley's, I can't call it impersonation, but her interpretation of Olivia Colman's character, and then with all of Olivia Colman's vocal mannerisms, her body language, I was just like, literally every scene going, give the best actress to Jessie Buckley. Oh no, give it to Olivia Colman. And I was going backwards and forwards the whole time. And again, to put it against Power of the Dog, Power of the Dog kind of lost me around about the halfway point, whereas I was on the edge of my seat throughout.
Interesting.
For The Lost Daughter.
Do you, I mean, because Alex and I saw both The Lost Daughter and Power of the Dog in Venice last year, and we had the luxury of being able to see it on a big screen. Do you think that there's, because I mean, I'm thrilled that Netflix have actually gone around to, you know, having at least a small theatrical window before the films, and both The Power of the Dog and The Lost Daughter are definitely big screen films. I mean, you know, they deserve to be seen on the widest canvas possible.
Okay, so possibly to return to South of the Meridian again, Death on the Nile, did it sink with everybody on board, or?
Oh, God.
I didn't see it.
Right, well, you're not missing much. Like, to
but this is what I heard. Like, I was waiting to hear the responses,
I mean, look,
and no one said anything.
I am a huge Poirot fan. I grew up on this shit. David Suchet, for me, is just wonderful. And I think Kenneth Branagh is a very good Poirot. I think he nails it. The problem is with this one, much like Murder on the Orient Express, it's just, I was so bored, and after a while I didn't care who done it. It was just one of those things where it was just like, I'm enjoying the dresses, oh well, that's some nice jewelry you're wearing, madam, kind of thing. And throughout the whole thing I just found myself zoning in on little details and not giving two shits about the central mystery.
That's the point.
I disagree.
That is,
but carry on. No, I
think a murder mystery movie, not about the murder.
No. But I think the murder mystery, particularly with reference to Murder on the Orient Express, is so well known, so out there. So the enjoyment in the film is in the way that the filmmakers approached it and dressed it and cast it. He's never going to be allowed, or never going to be, you know, he's never going to be allowed to tamper with the plot line or tamper with the outcome, or tamper too much with the structure in the sense that everybody gets into one room at the end and
sure,
da, da, da.
But I like that structure, and I don't expect it to be tampered with. I at least expect to be, because I couldn't remember. I remembered about Murder on the Orient Express. Everyone kind of vaguely knows, and it's entered into popular culture, or did they murder on the Orient Express him, kind of thing, you know, that everyone's, you know, guilty. But here I was just like, I couldn't remember who'd done it. But I don't care. I actively just find this meandering approach to it. Just, it looks good, but I was in no way hooked by any of it.
The other thing I enjoyed was the whole WWF acting side of it, about whose portrayal shone the brightest.
Yeah.
Interesting, I didn't know this. I mean, I read all the stuff about Gal Gadot being like terrible in it, and I don't know what to interpret.
I'm sorry.
She's walking furniture on this one, I'm afraid.
She's awful, and I'm terribly sorry. Like, because I think she is one of these kind of classical kind of Audrey Hepburn kind of style, like, you know, illuminating the screen, and she is wonderful when she gets the right role. But quite frankly, just everything from her delivery to just, Why cast her in this? I know that was, but even the rest, like, I didn't think like Armie Hammer or even Russell Brand.
I thought Russell Brand was good. Russell Brand was a revelation for me.
Oh right, I just didn't think he was given that much to do.
Oh, granted, but
I mean, that's the nature of the character. My problem is that for this film, Alex, just so you know, they give Poirot his moustache an origin story.
Ooh, this sounds exciting, though.
Right.
Now I kind of want to.
Because it starts off not in Egypt, but it starts off and you understand why Poirot, you know, has a moustache that has a moustache.
Mate, you're selling this. People are now
downloading
this movie now.
So stupid that after a while you're just like, that's it. No, I just preferred it when I knew he had a really illustrious moustache. It's just, that was just also, what are you doing? What possible good can come of this?
I think there's a reason, and the moustache has got the sequel.
Jesus. And also, okay, no, this is one of my things, and it goes back to and I think this is the most mildly intelligent point I can make about this film, is that you're being given the keys to the kingdom with Agatha Christie's backstories. Why are you making the ones that everyone knows?
Everything you've told me about this, I'm sold on. I'm like, I want to see the mustache story. I want to see what you're talking about. Okay, David, what are you on the Perov universe, please?
I'm awaiting my phone call from Mr. Branagh yesterday. But at the same time, they really need to, if they're going to continue, and they will, to actually go a little bit deeper into Agatha Christie's stories and not make the ones that we've seen over and over again.
So since we're on Kenneth Branagh...
Oh, Belfast.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this because it's my other least favourite. Does anyone... Do you like it, Mark? Please say no.
It has virtues.
Garçon, I'm going to need some more.
Yeah, it has... what's her name? The main mom is a virtue? I will give you that much.
It has virtues. I think in the plus column, it's not realistic. It's not completely fantasy. It exists in some kind of middle space. And given the controversial nature of the subject matter, that was actually a very astute and smart way to go about setting the tone of the movie. Mm-hmm. Because if you'd gone to either extreme, there is no way that 90 minutes or a 2-hour movie can do justice to what happened in Northern Ireland. So I think that was a very, very smart move. But obviously with that comes an Achilles heel, which is that a lot of things seem to happen, or information arrives by the television, by the radio. And so it's all kind of happening off camera. Mm-hmm. I think Kieran Hines is totally... He's a really, really good performance, and yes, I think a Best Supporting Actor nod was justified. But it's funny, because when I watched the trailer, and I need to go back and watch the trailer again, I was convinced it was a musical.
Interesting.
That would have been a better film.
I'm with Alex on this one, and you know, you won't be hearing that much during this podcast because, I mean, we've got the Batman coming up. But the thing is that I'm with you, and I appreciate the courage it took to kind of have that sort of, you know, we're not going full realism, we're not going full... But, I mean, at the same time, then it exists in that awkward space where there's this kind of misty-eyed romanticism of it. Mm-hmm. And I do really appreciate what he's doing, and I do like see, you know, from the child's eye point of view kind of thing, which and I didn't necessarily, I wasn't looking for a film that was going to be overtly political or that even had the pretense or the, you know, the sheer chutzpah of trying to kind of make the ultimate Troubles film.
Yeah.
But I found that kind of sweetened brand of nostalgia really flattening. And it's not to say that there aren't plenty of things that I don't admire about this film. I do, but I came out of it just thinking this is a kind of almost a shameless Oscar bid, and I think it's going to play very, very well with Oscar voters. And I genuinely think that they're going to bottle it and not give it to Power of the Dog and give it to Belfast.
No, please say no. That would be a great travesty. Even over the other 9 nominees, like, come on.
But I think this is the thing with the film, is that it's a portrait of a community that was lost, mm-hmm. rather than necessarily how it descended into sectarian violence.
Yeah.
And as a coda to that, and on reflection, I actually think it would make a better stage play than it would make a film.
Sure.
Because that middle space of fantasy versus reality, mm-hmm. would have a better home.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. It's a hard film to be particularly angry about, but this is one of them where I was just like, much like King Richard, for example, which is also in the Oscars, it's just like, perfectly fine. I wasn't angry while watching it, but I just think it really hasn't kind of stayed with me in any way.
Yeah, and really, really, really strongly not stayed with me. I even saw it twice to show my partner a few months after I first saw it, and like, it further made me dislike it.
Okay.
It was with time and with distance, it actually made me, in the context of this podcast, further realize how not great it is, and further confirm that. And
yes.
That's the weird thing with the film, because the film is about courage, and yet I felt the filmmakers lacked the courage to go to the slightly darker side, the slightly more realistic. You know, I applaud the fact that, you know, it sort of explains and shows how this family came out of the ruins of America and what it is to live on the breadline. But Will Smith, best Oscar, or best acting Oscar, rather. Well, this is the thing, is that it's a good performance, but if I was going to give Will Smith an Oscar for acting, I'd have given it to him for Ali. This is not that film. I think if the Oscar nod does unfortunately have that feeling of, when are we going to get a chance to give this to this guy?
Yeah.
Because he's...
I don't think he's bad. I just think he's like good enough. But like you're saying, he's not, it's not his best by any means.
But he's usually in sort of, dare I say, middle of the road entertainment fare, which is never going to trouble the Academy.
Yeah.
And so, and until he starts resolutely going after dramatic roles, he's not really going to be in the frame, so to speak.
King Richard is another very fine, like middle of the road kind of film. Mm-hmm. I dislike Belfast probably the most, but King Richard to me is like, I don't hate it, I don't love it, I enjoy some of it. I like the story, but I'm not amazed.
I'm just thinking about the next grenade I'm about to throw into the middle here. So what do you think about Jennifer Lopez in Marry Me?
I haven't actually seen it yet.
Right. Well, I have, and I feel lighter because my soul was eroded by this saccharine bullshit that genuinely apes Notting Hill, and there is nothing that is redeemable about that film. And I love Jennifer Lopez. I thought that she was fantastic in Hustlers and all of that. I think she's even more brilliant in Out of Sight, the one with George Clooney in 1998. My problem, Marry Me? No, absolutely not.
So to answer Russell Crowe's question, I was entertained.
Okay.
And
good, but
and you know, Mark, I know it's
why? Why? Tell me why? Because right now I'm having a breakdown, and why? Why, Mark? Why? Why? Why?
Because it was silly, it was fluffy, it knew that it was silly and it was fluffy, and there was one line, one instance in the entire film which made me think, you didn't need to do that, but I'm glad you did. Which was the line where Owen Wilson's being badgered by Jennifer Lopez, PA, to appear on The Tonight Show.
Yes.
And he basically turns around and goes, no, I'm feeding my kids when I go home. That's what I'm doing. And he actually, you know, I thought, that's cool. That's really cemented your character in my eyes.
What character? It's Owen Wilson bumbling about, like wearing sensible shirts.
You just described his character.
Well, I mean,
so much better in Loki.
Love you to bits, but I mean, come on. Surely you must have been entertained by something more than Marry Me.
I'll give you a choice.
This is my favorite negative opinion here far. You really hated this.
I wanted fluff, and I wanted to be David, just maybe solidly we need, entertained.
David, maybe we need to get you married to someone randomly in a concert, and then you can experience some beauty in your heart that will make you love this movie more. We're going to put you through the exact same situation and see how you turn
out. I'd rather not.
Maybe you will turn into Owen Wilson.
As the devil's advocate, you're at the gates of hell, you're given the choice of watching two films for eternity. The Bodyguard, whoops, somebody's just died there. The Bodyguard or Marry Me.
Hold on, The Bodyguard is in Kevin Costner being an absolute legend.
I think it's a good parallel.
How can you say that? Bodyguard is a classic.
The Bodyguard is wonderful. The Bodyguard any day of the week. I'll happily rewatch that tonight.
Give
How could you? No.
I've had more fun watching paint dry. Where
did this Bodyguard disc come from?
Essentially, it's the pop star meets the person in the street. It's the combination of their lives thrown together. They fall into love.
Please, where there is discord, let me sow harmony. The Fifth Element is a better film. Let's carry on.
Okay, yeah, that ends all the
time. That ends everything. What else?
So, I mean, I think we're kind of whittling...
Spider-Man.
I was about to say, I think we're kind of whittling...
So I'm going to say Batman for last.
Yeah, okay, sure. Do you know what? If I can throw one in called The Reason I Jump...
That was like 2 years ago.
Maybe 2 years ago when it premiered in festivals. I think it was at CPH Docs, if I'm not mistaken. And I absolutely adore this film. It's like by Jerry Rothwell. And it reminded me enormously of a film called Notes on Blindness, a 2016 film. And it is this, again, an adaptation by this Japanese teenager about... non-verbal autism, and you get this kind of sensory, audio, visual kind of beautiful insight into what that perspective must feel like. And at first I thought, my God, if it's going to be gimmicky, this could go really tits up really fast. But I thought it was one of the most just beautifully filmed, beautifully scored, just never gimmicky and constantly empathetic films that I've seen in a very, very long time. And that documentary blew me away. And the more people can see that, because not only does it challenge some of the preconceptions that neurotypical people and audiences may have towards nonverbal autism, but it genuinely has this, you know, capacity to portray like this untranslatable feeling on the big screen that is just glorious. That's one of, and I only mention it because I saw it, I think, like Alex said, 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. I rewatched it recently and was blown away by it all over again. Mm-hmm. And it is masterful, nothing short of masterful.
Talking about untranslatable feelings, I feel sorry that Come On, Come On seems to have kind of slipped from view. Because I thought it was an amazing film.
I love Come On, Come On.
Really?
I blame it on the release strategy. Okay. Like they... I think it was one of the A24 films that they completely cut Europe out of. Mm-hmm. It played no festivals in Europe. It had no release in Europe. It had nothing to do with Europe, which I think is a huge failure in a global world where everyone talks amongst each other now. And... it got a release in the US, slowly started, and then the rest of us started to see it. And then as we started to see it, we've been catching up to its warmth. Mm-hmm. But it's a very hard sell from the beginning. Like a black and white drama. The biggest thing you can sell is Joaquin Phoenix, which is not enough to really get people in. And it's like, you have to be ready to go in to appreciate the beauty of what Mike Mills is trying to do with it. And I think like most people are going to, like if you're a film nerd, but I don't think the general audience is going to be into it that way.
Really?
I mean, I hope,
okay.
But I don't feel that way. I think my point is, I think if the marketing and the release eased people into it and built the hype correctly, mm-hmm. it could have played well and it could have been something more. And I think much like you, Mark, I've just been like, the whole season I've been like, I love this film, but no one cares about it.
Yeah, that's just interesting.
You know, I liked it a lot. I thought it was a little bit overindulgent. Mm. And the use of flashbacks and the voiceover kind of didn't sit well with me. Mm. I could have done without that. But again, I mean, I'm a lot more positive on it than anything else. I thought, like, also that young kid, Woody Norman
was great.
Who is absolutely brilliant. And I have to admit, the whole kind of precocious child thing can get grating really, really fast. But I thought the chemistry between Joaquin Phoenix and Woody Norman was spot on.
Yeah.
I think I'd love to watch it again because I think it hit me when I saw it the first time and I wasn't in the right mood for it.
I think I
wasn't quite in the headspace of being... you know, this the floodgate opening and this sentimentality, which usually I'm a complete sucker for. And I'm sure that when I rewatch it again, I'm going to be won over by it a lot more. But it's interesting because it's also... Is it Oscar nominated this year? Has it got any sort
like
of Oscar traction?
Screenplay? I don't know. That's had like one nomination, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. I know, I mean, it had Indie Spirit nominations. But in general, it's kind of been, like you're saying, it's kind of been not swept under the rug, but like... I think the other problem is in this award season, when you put it up against the other contenders, even Lost Daughter and Power of the Dog, you're like, well, I'll go for those two. Mm-hmm. And sadly, even against Belfast, the voters are going to lean towards the other black and white movie more than they are Come On, Come On. And I think for all that I've done with Mike Mills, I mean, I think I love everything he's ever made. I know I love everything he's made, and I know he has the style that I'm gonna dig, but I don't know how many other people do, mm-hmm. and will be into that as much as mm-hmm. we are.
Yeah. Well, speaking about hard sell black and white movies, I was blown away by the tragedy of Macbeth.
Okay, you were blown away by it.
I thought it was sublime. It's one of those films where I'm rubbing my hands eagerly waiting for the Blu-ray release because it's sumptuous, and that's not just the cinematography, the acting, the staging, and also the adaptation of the screenplay. I didn't feel like there were any obvious omissions in the script and in the story, and it's just glorious.
Okay. I mean, I agree with you on an aesthetical level. I think it is beautiful and it is really, really, really strong. The acting is great, specifically the acting of the woman who plays the witch.
I think she's getting a Best Supporting.
I genuinely would have given her all the awards just because she has that raspy, I've been gurgling razor blades sort of voice, and she is perfect in that role. I really liked it too, but I have to admit, and I feel like Scrooge during this whole kind of episode, but it's not one that stayed with me though. I appreciate it. I wanted something more from it, and I'm not quite sure what. But yeah, no, I still thought it was great, and I enjoyed... Do you know what? I actually do know what... When you have Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand as the power couple, I wanted more scenes between them. And I felt bizarrely, having seen Macbeth many times on stage, having studied it at university and so on and so forth, I remembered in my head, and maybe this is like me remembering falsely, but that there were more scenes between them, and I was really looking forward to kind of them kind of playing off each other. And that was my one bum note, and it's a minor one, but I can't deny it reminded me afterwards of the Macbeth with Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard. Mm-hmm. And there I got the to and fro between the two. I got this kind of knotty, perverse, but also incredibly complementary relationship where they feed off each other's hate and ambition. And yeah, that was kind of missing for me here. I didn't get that. And maybe that was the point. Maybe he wanted to explore, Joel Cohen wanted to explore something else. But yeah.
I have to confess that now that you've pointed that out, I agree. I actually think McDormand's Lady Macbeth is actually underfed.
With that cast, with that caliber of acting, I was missing a few scenes between them.
Yeah,
but
you go.
No, I fall into the category of Shakespeare generally doesn't hit me hard. And I know, I always am afraid to say this, but then I know some people came out and said this about Tragedy of Macbeth too, where I'm like, I nothing against the stories, nothing against Shakespeare, I always am impressed by it. I just like, I'm never moved by it. I mean, it's not that there isn't possibility of that, and of course, like, I dare age myself by saying the Baz Luhrmann, Romeo and Juliet being a beautiful kind of reinvention of what Shakespeare can be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, like this one, it's like, I can't say anything bad about the creation and the making and the everything aesthetically of the film, but I just like had no emotional movement at all, felt nothing about it. And I think there's a to answer your question, aside from what David pointed out, I think there's a class of us who are like, Shakespeare, like, what are you gonna do new? I mean, we just had another Macbeth movie a few years ago. Like, what is, you know, I don't want to say Shakespeare is a hard sell because he's been selling for hundreds of years now, but if you go out to the general, like if you were to walk on the street right now and say, how many of you would come see a Shakespeare movie different than a play? How many people would be like, yes, I'll go see that right now?
I think there are two films that I would recommend people see. Othello with Lawrence Fishburne. Honestly, career best Kenneth Branagh as Iago, and that will make you feel. And the other one, less so, but a fantastic staging, Coriolanus.
Yes, with the Ralph Fiennes. Yeah, okay.
Oh, right. I haven't seen it.
That's very good. And Gerard Butler is actually very, very good in that as well.
It's high watermark. Yeah.
However, Mark.
Did I miss one?
Is it time for David to riot? Yeah.
Fucking heathens.
Yeah,
how dare you not in any point mention 10 Things I Hate About You? The Taming of the Shrew, revisited as a coming-of-age comedy in American High School.
But this is almost a whole other discussion of taking a script and turning it into something different versus adapting directly.
But it is a very good direct adaptation. All the beats are there, my God. And Julia Stiles.
But I have another one. My Private Idaho.
Yes, fine.
I think that is a cracking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Henry V done differently.
But these are, but to me, this is a, I mean, again, we could have a whole podcast on Shakespeare alone, but this is, to me, the point of which Power of the Dog didn't overly succeed is that it is a literal, direct, language-to-language, put-on-screen, straight-up, stage-to-screen adaptation, which I'm the kind of person who's like, if I want to see that, I'd rather go see it at the stage.
Shakespeare does not fit naturally into 90 minutes.
Yeah, and I mean, the language is still sometimes distant to me, and I again, it's like I've always felt, ever since we began studying it in grade school, I've always felt like I appreciate and admire it. It just doesn't move me.
I think a lot of Shakespeare, as with a lot of stage adaptations, really heavily depend upon the carrier, the person who's doing the performance.
Exactly.
If just to come off films ever so slightly, there is a video which I've seen of Michael Sheen doing Under Milk Wood.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a very dense and almost impenetrable verse, and yet he totally brings it to life, gives it color, gives everything weight. You don't miss any details, and I think it really does depend on who's doing the telling, because we've seen good Shakespeare, and then there's bad Shakespeare. And a lot of it hinges on the performance and the interpretation, because the iambic meter is something that is really open to reinterpretation. And so that's, and I think that's why actors and actresses love it so much, because it's something where they can actually put their own spin on it without necessarily changing the words.
When Alex was saying, sorry to kind of, well, we're doing a bit of a tangent, Alex was saying about seeing stuff on stage. There is one film which I saw this year, which I think, and Alex will probably know this better than me, I think it premiered in some festivals last year, but I think it's finally come out and on various streaming platforms. It's called Boiling Point.
Oh, yeah.
It's a film that's, it's filmed in one take.
Oh, this is the Stephen Graham.
Stephen Graham. Absolutely. And I watched that a few weeks ago and was completely blown away by it. I have an absolute soft spot for all films that are week low, set in one space, or films that dare to essentially do the one take thing, that have a certain theatricality to it. And this obviously is a one take. It's not, you know, let's go through a doorway to have an invisible cut kind of thing. No. And I love the theatricality of it, and I loved every single part of the tension. That central performance by Stephen Graham is mind-blowing.
You had me there, because I mean, I've got a soft spot for Stephen Graham, full stop.
It's so, so good. And it basically, to give you a rough gist, and there isn't much of a plot to it really, is it's one night in a very busy London restaurant, and he's the head chef, and slowly but surely certain kind of things start encroaching into this world and start ruining the evening. And it does it so subtly, and it doesn't go for the big emotions. And it was absolutely spot on. So that is one of my highlights of the year, Boiling Point. I'd recommend that. And it's very taut, kind of pacey, I think, 85 minutes, and done, and beautiful.
I'm curious about this.
Just to continue this off-piste film moment, I have now watched in its entirety Slow Horses, and it is required viewing.
Okay.
It's a new series on Apple, which to all intents and purposes looks and feels like a BBC spy thriller.
Oh, lovely.
Gary Oldman.
Oh.
And a cast to die for.
Ooh.
Gary Oldman and Kirsten Scott Thomas are squaring off against each other, and she's the big head honcho of MO5, and he is the disgraced reject with his other rejects who have been shuffled off.
What are we talking here? Is it like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy?
We're talking six episodes of 50 minutes plus excellence. It's not trying to be Smiley's People or Le Carré, but it's in that middle space between Spooks and Le Carré. It acknowledges and is aware of Le Carré's kind of world and take on spying. Mm-hmm. But it basically is a drama about, if you enjoy seeing English people of all different classes and backgrounds kicking the shit out of each other. This is, and Gary Oldman is just, this is one for the ages.
Oh, okay.
This is, it's interesting because he's the polar opposite of his George Smiley.
Nice. I'm looking forward to that. Okay, Slow Horses.
So in terms of Needle, now I know that you have reservations about this film and the filmmaker. I'm going to talk about Blue Bayou.
Okay. I haven't seen it,
actually. Oh, have you seen it?
I have seen it, yeah. I don't remember most of it, to be completely honest.
This is
not going to be great podcasting, because I'm going to hold my hands up. We see so many films that I have to admit, Blue Bayou, it's one of those ones where when I saw the list and stuff that you gave, like, you know, yeah, potential films that we might be talking about, I went back and looked at my scribbled notes that I did during the screenings, and I was just like, I really don't remember watching this film. So, yeah, I've seen it, but I am just shrugging at you now.
I'm just not a Justin Chan fan. Like, this was, I had seen his other two and were like, they're not for me. I do not like them at all. And it was like, I made the conscious decision to not see this.
What is it about him that you don't like, Alex? Oh, here we go.
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this on the podcast. No, I just think he's...
If you don't start, you don't finish. So
I just think he's a terrible filmmaker. He has no vision. He's obsessed with himself and his own stories that have nothing to tell. He's horrible. The funniest thing to me was that his one before this, Miss something? Miss June or... The one he did right before this one?
Miss Juneteenth? No.
No. It's like, I don't know. But I thought this is some of the worst cinematography I've ever seen in my entire life. And lo and behold, other people at the same festival who had just seen the same film were like, this is some of the best cinematography I've ever seen. And I'm like, it's how? But I just cannot stand his filmmaking. However, this one is apparently... It's not his own story this time, and some of the criticism I read was basically like he went off of what he was doing well, which, not that I agree, but like I actually was like, oh good, they're criticizing this film in a way that I like.
Okay, well, point one, I haven't seen any of his other films.
Okay.
If the concern was the cinematography, he's found himself a cinematographer for this film. No question of that whatsoever. I shed a tear at the end, which is rare for me.
Okay.
And it really became very, very affecting. And I didn't think that it was... Obviously, he's the central character, but I didn't feel like it was self-obsessed.
That's the point in this, because it's Alicia Vikander is the main character, right?
Oh, she's one of the main characters. And it's really... It creeps up on you, because you're watching it, you're thinking, okay, this is good, this is fine, it's solid, yeah, it's ticking boxes, and then bang, at the end, it has you in pieces. And I was really surprised that it didn't get more attention, it didn't get more noise.
Maybe it's because film critics like myself just can't remember it. I think I had one or two to make. I need to rewatch it then, because if you had that strong reaction to it, I need to just completely... My mind is a blank on this one.
I think maybe because you had kind of intimated that this was not going to be a favourable experience, I went in there with possibly lowered
that
expectations.
Always works, though. When you lower your expectations, you usually enjoy something more. He's one of those filmmakers where I'm like, I know it's not my thing, to the point where I just won't comment on him anymore. Like, if other people like his films and enjoy what he does, totally fine with me. Mm-hmm. And go right ahead. I just know he's just not for me. Like, that's as much as I can say.
So was Studio 666 for you?
This is also easily forgotten.
Oh man, it lived and died in the space of one night.
But you said it, because we talked about it after.
Yeah.
You said it right, which is that it's based... I mean, this is, of course, their whole point is it's for Foo Fighter fans, and they know they made it for Foo Fighter fans. I mean, it's literally, let's have some rock songs in it and show us making an album. And I wanted to give it a chance, which I did, and I mildly enjoyed it, you know, like a... This will sound really snobby, but it's true. It's like, thank goodness I didn't have to pay for it and I went to a press screening, you know? Like, that kind of thing. Like,
but Alex, I have to admit, like, I'll hold my hands up. I am a Foo Fighters fan. Ooh. And I know, but the thing is
that
not yeah, and not in, not necessarily okay. anymore. I haven't really liked any of the albums, but I can't deny that a part of my growing up with the first kind of 2-3 albums of the Foo Fighters, I still think Colour in the Shape is an absolute masterpiece, and I will re-listen to that one until the day I die. The thing is that with this, I couldn't get over how long it was and how long it felt, yeah, because it needed to be an 80-minute kind of, you know, gag. And I think I would have had a lot more goodwill towards Studio 666 if that had been the case. But also, I appreciate the fact that it dared to be gory. Yeah, I enjoyed the gore. I was just like, actually, do you know what? Fine, fair enough, because I thought this was going to be like, you know, just... but I mean, it just is very self-indulgent. And just, even as a Foo Fighters fan, I'm like, I don't really need to see this. I don't much care.
I think the biggest flaw, which is, again, that this was part of it. It's not even a flaw. It's like in the making, but the makings are bad, is that none of the rest of the Foo Fighters are capable of any kind of acting.
Oh, no.
Like Dave Grohl is barely good enough.
Yeah.
But everyone else, which is the rest of the movie.
I mean, Taylor Hawkins in particular. He was just like, every time he was like delivering a line of dialogue, I was just like, kill me.
And I know it's hard to get around that because like, this is the movie about the band, but you're like, if that's the most of the movie, it makes it a little bit grating to enjoy.
Yeah.
And it kind of, you're like, at some point...
I mean, my problem is that I think the only way that you can really enjoy that film, and I mean this in a kind of loving sense, because I didn't outright hate it.
Yeah, me either.
But I just think it is one of those films that you need to watch with shots when you're actually actively, like, you know, getting progressively drunk.
So you need something that exists between you and the screen.
Yes. Yeah, I need some social lubricant. I need a full bottle of Jack and just like gradually just like topping myself up. And then I might get into it a little bit more, but
just take your face mask and move it over your eyes. That'll do the job.
Okay, well, fair. Right. What next?
What did you guys make of Red Rocket?
I loved Red Rocket.
Yeah. Isn't it such a great film?
It's brilliant. And I, you know, Simon Rex, the your main man, he won Best Actor at the Spirit Awards, I cheered. I was like, yes, finally, because that film, unfortunately, will not get much awards kind of attention. I absolutely loved it, and genuinely, when we were talking about needle drops and stuff like that, and my God, I mean, the best use of NSYNC's Bye 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 ever. I mean, glorious film. I loved every minute of that, and so funny. And like Florida Project before it, and what was the one before? Tangerine?
Tangerine.
Yes. Yeah. So, and I love the fact that he can comment on small town America and those communities without looking down on them, without at any moment feeling like he's being patronizing or an outsider to it. And the way essentially that film plays out, which is about strengthening the bonds within a community to kind of expel this nuisance, this parasite that's come in, and I don't think it's any kind of coincidence that the film is set in 2016 with the rise of Trump, and you know, you have this swaggering dickhead who comes in who is very likable in his, you know, in the fact that he does believe that he can mold his environment to what he wants, and he has that self-confidence, and I mean, he is a Trumpian figure in his own way, and I think as a mild piece of political allegory, it's quite remarkable because it doesn't necessarily play like that on the first viewing, and I've seen it 3 times now, and the more I looked at it, the more I mean, you know, without trying to read too much into it, I also think it's a brilliant comedy. It's so funny, and I love Red Rocket.
I think the 2 things that really stood out were the actress whose name I forget who played Strawberry.
Yes,
I thought she was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because for her character to work, she needed to bring a certain dynamic, and she had it, and she was totally zeroed in on it, and didn't try to make the scenes solely about her or sort of take Susanna Son. Thank you.
Susanna Son. Okay.
Yeah, nice. Didn't try and make the scene about her. Or try and get into any kind of acting one-upmanship. And then the ending, the 2 endings, the first ending where everything breaks down, and then the open ending, which is the actual finale, which can be taken either way that you want to, I thought was genius.
Yes.
I think it's also one of the few films ever to be made that very brilliantly handles the ickiness of a horribly disgusting, especially in context of what we're dealing with now, main character, and also doesn't make the film horribly disgusting in what it shows.
Yeah,
it's really, really hard to do that at all, and then really, really hard to do that and make the movie entertaining and engaging. Like you're like, you say he's likable. I mean, he's likable in a charismatic sort of way, but he's still a piece of shit,
yeah,
you know? Absolutely. And it's there's so many films have tried that recently because they're trying to address how horrible men are and all this, but so many of them never get it right and can never balance not only the humor, but the, like, genuineness of also how well he is, or how good he is at grooming this girl, and how good he is at actually succeeding and convincing her to go do this and, like, getting her to... And part of it is the challenge of making you feel uncomfortable watching him do that to her while also being like, oh, this is fun and enjoyable as a movie.
Yeah.
And I think only few filmmakers can ever get that right. And I think Sean Baker is one of the few who's actually, at least with this one, done that. And I'm curious what he does, like, what kind of topics will he do in the future that are really, like, challenging topics to handle and still pull it off.
I think you've voiced that really quite brilliantly, because that was it for me with this character, is that no matter how loathsome he is and how annoying he is, because of his charisma and it kind of gets the balance right. And a part of me thought, especially him trying to strike up this relationship with a much younger woman, I was like, oh god, this could go icky, and it is icky, and it doesn't feel right. But for some reason, and I think, like I said, you've said it really wonderfully there, Alex, that it's just, it skirts that, and it still addresses it without, like, losing your audience.
Yeah,
and I thought it was a really, really, tricky thing to do, and he pulled it off so well.
I was bracing for a huge negative, response to this, you know, people being like, oh, how dare you like this movie, he's so disgusting, because then of course the intelligent response to that is, yes, that's in the movie, that's literally what it's about, but that doesn't mean you have to make it a horribly depressing drama. You can do it differently and still make something good. And
you can,
he's done that.
You can portray a loathsome character without being loathsome yourself.
Exactly.
It's a story. Exactly. And it's not because, like, the character is loathsome than the filmmaker is, or that the whole story needs to be thrown away with that.
Exactly.
Oh no, I will go to bat for Ed Rocket any day of the week. Yeah.
It hasn't received negative conversation, which is good. I just think, unfortunately, it hasn't received much positive conversation. I mean, amongst critics, yes, but outside of critics, not. I don't know.
But if I'm not mistaken, it comes out in Germany next month, and I am.
There
is a slow rollout in the rest of Europe, and I am very curious to see how it is received.
Because I could see it being like a big hit here in Germany. It's the kind of thing that could find a huge audience, like an unexpectedly huge audience, you know, where it, like, plays every summer here, and we're like, oh, we had no idea that Germans and Berliners love Red Rocket so much, but
fair,
they do.
Well, his previous films, Tangerine and The Florida Project, worked very well in Germany and also in France, for that matter. So I think there could be a chance that it does very well here.
I mean, talking about sleepers and breakthroughs, Alex put me on to Brian and Charles, which
you
was...
You didn't see this one, did you?
No.
Okay. Oh, such a...
I'm glad you keep talking about it. This is one of my, like... I have to be humble, except for this moment where I say, I'm glad I introduced this to you, Mark, because now you're, like, the biggest champion of this film.
It is such a beautifully pitched, in terms of tone, a beautifully pitched kind of story. The simplistic way to kind of get it across to an audience would be Wallace and Gromit made flesh, but it's subtler than that. It's a genteel humour. You've got the shades of the Iron Giant in there. It's such a beautifully, beautifully observed comedy.
Okay.
It's a black comedy without going dark.
Yeah.
Oh, and
there's a nice tenderness with the friendship and what they go through.
To just kind of put some meat on the bones, you've got this guy who's quite how he's managing to survive without a job, but he's an inventor where he invents things that nobody wants, and then he finds one day a disused washing machine, and hey presto, and by the suspension of reality, the next morning he's made a robot.
Okay, like a sentient robot.
And then the robot develops sentience.
Oh.
and it's the adventures that they have after that moment.
Lovely.
And it's all sort of in dank, deep, rural North Wales, and...
Oh, it's set in North Wales?
Yeah.
I think you're going to like it a lot.
I'm not going to lie, like, I'm sold. I am going to watch this, because this sounds brilliant.
It's such a charmer. It's okay. Such a charmer. Again, if you go into it with no sort of, like, pre-spiel or reading the plot or any of that kind of stuff, just go into it cold.
Okay.
Because it is such a... Yeah, it's... It's one of those movies. I think when I was talking to Alex about it, and he asked me, he said, what do I think? And I said, this is one of those movies that you're going to give to somebody else and say, watch this. You're going to love this. This is a film you're going to recommend.
Nice. Okay.
And it's going to leave you in a very happy place by the time you finish.
I love when you discover one of those gems and you know vividly that, you know, if you do give it as a recommendation, that they will go off and watch it, and it will kind of, you know, have that treacle effect of them recommending it to somebody else. Yeah.
Okay. And it already did. We're almost like months ahead of the curve on this one, because at Sundance, it premiered, and like no one saw it. Then in the last few days, a lot of people were like, oh, someone told me to see this, and I watched it and I loved it. Yeah. And it was so gratifying to see that, because I was like, okay, great, this film I've wanted people to see, now, like you're saying, they've been recommended it and they ended up loving it too, which is like, I think that's going to be the life of this film, is it's going to go through this like process of probably no one sees it at release, but people are going to love it and like give it to their friends, and it's going to build and build and build, and like, you know, someone's going to discover it 3 years now down the line from now and like completely change their life because Brian and Charles, you know, inspired them.
No, I mean, it was a nice gem.
The only ones left are like Spider-Man and Batman.
No, listen. Should we go on to the big one at this point?
For those of you that have stuck with us thus far, we are approaching the bottom of the barrel, and Spider-Man No Way Home rears its head, beautiful or ugly or otherwise. I mean, how do we feel about it now that all the rabbits have been pulled out of the hat? For me, Andrew Garfield is the gift that just keeps on giving.
Yeah, I mean, I like the, also, I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that this is like, you know, the film that saved cinema kind of thing. It's done so well, you know, it's gone, it's done absolute monster box office numbers. I think I had a great time with it. And I remember we all saw it, the three of us together at the press screening, and you know there was whooping, and there was, you know,
I think there was
a lot of goodwill. But the thing is that now that I think about it, and I, especially in the context of all of Marvel films as well, I can't deny that I don't know, I'd much rather rewatch Into the Spider-Verse, which this film is very much, you know, taking a page out of. And as much as I absolutely love seeing all three Spider-Men together and all of that, I do like Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange. I think it does do some interesting things. My problem is that if you're going to do this multiverse thing, which it's going to carry on with Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, if you are going to bring back villains, give the villains something to do, because I really loved Willem Dafoe as the Goblin. He had a great time. He was fantastic. But the problem with that is that when you've focused so much on him, Jamie Foxx was non-existent. Yeah. The Lizard, Rifi Fans as the Lizard, and even Doc Ock. I mean, that Rogues Gallery never really went anywhere. I almost just wish they just got the Green Goblin and that was it. I mean, it's perfectly fine. I don't know what you, how you guys have lived with it.
I think you said it as well. Also, that as a Marvel movie, it's kind of like it's in the Marvel soup, which is now, oh, guess what? There's another one coming up, and guess that's like.
Yeah.
And I know that this is dangerous territory, because all the Marvel fans are gonna come and, you know, burn down my building for saying this, but like it's just it's just another, like, as much as I enjoy it, as much as I would rank it high in the Marvel, the Marvel universe, I'd be like, it's just another Marvel movie. Yeah. You know, even though it's not even a Disney Marvel movie, it still is very much a Marvel movie.
Okay, so how about this? In the context of Spider-Man films...
Right.
I put it in the top half. Like, underneath Spider-Man 2, underneath Into the Spider-Verse, I mean, maybe even the first...
Tom Holland.
Yeah, even that one. Like,
I was a huge fan.
But I would rank it above so many others as well. Like, yeah. I very much enjoyed it. Actually, the most interesting argument I had was with a friend of mine here in Berlin who loves Spider-Man movies and loves the first two and did not like this. And I was blown away. And her main reasoning was, oh, she just wanted more high school humor like the first two. And I was like, yeah, but... You have that in these movies, and they're doing something different here, which I think is much more emotional and deep, like dealing with the ultimate Into the Spider-Verse question of who is and what is Spider-Man. And of course you don't like that because it's not the goofy high school humor, but you can't stay goofy high school humor forever and ever
not
and ever.
Not for the third movie.
Yeah, exactly.
But okay, my main thing, and I have to admit, I am with your friend, but I mean, I'm not upset that there wasn't any of that high school humor anymore because we've already had it, and this character is growing, and they made it a plot point as well that they're about to go to college and stuff like that. So I'm not mad about that, but I have to admit, the specifically the first one, of the Tom Holland, Homecoming, I like that. I like that kind of John Hughes kind of spirit that was like there. I love the soundtrack, and I don't know, that to me was a lot stronger than this. Also, the plot point, and I'm sorry, I know it's not about that. He gets demasked and essentially, you know, becomes the social pariah and stuff like that. And because of him, his friends can't go to college. And, you know, I'm with the whole Doctor Strange thing. It's just like, you didn't just call the dean. You've actively kind of, you know, opened up the multiverse instead of picking up the phone and calling the dean and just basically, you know, and which works in the end for them.
But it's so much cooler.
Oh, sorry. If you're going to tear, you know, the fabric of the universe, do it for a good reason. I mean, you know, in this case, exhaust some avenues beforehand.
So
is it that time?
Well, we're circling because did either of you guys see Serrano?
I did. Yes.
I did. Yeah. Very recently.
Oh my God! Listen to the silence.
I don't understand the extreme love that some people have. I think it's a beautifully made film. Yeah. I enjoy the songs, but the people who are like losing their shit calling it like the best thing they've ever seen, best musical, I'm like, I don't know where you're getting that from. Yeah.
My problem is, again, a little bit circling back to Death on the Nile, is we don't need another one of these. We really, really do not. However, Peter Dinklage is fantastic. He gets the rhyme and the measure, and it's so perfect. My problem is that you remove Peter Dinklage from that, or you get another actor, it is a weaker film. And also, I thought the songs were pretty rubbish. There isn't a hummable one.
There's one song at the end.
Really? Okay.
The one when they're on the battlefield.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. I don't know. I mean, if you are going to make a musical about Serrano de Bergerac, you better have some tunes.
I think the film dies in the first scene. And by that, I mean the first scene is so good
that the rest
of the film fails to meet that.
Yeah. I literally, as soon as I finished it, because I had a digital screener, I went back and rewatched that first scene again just to like relive that glory.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it's also the perfect example of a stage adaptation having a stage moment and making you feel pulled into the story because it's a stage moment with him. And I was like, yeah! And then the rest of it, I'm like, what happened to that? The magic of that scene you just had. Yeah. That's what I lacked.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But again, Peter Dinklage is remarkable in it. I mean, when is he not? But the thing is that I think he deserved a better vehicle. And again, why go back to these stories that we've seen countless times? Surely there's, you know, better time for him.
So with that in mind about going back in stories that we've had countless times...
Is it time?
Just stop teasing me and just get it over and done with.
It's time for the Cillian Murphy, the Bat.
Time for David to get vengeance on all of us with his...
Oh, God. What he has to say. I mean, look.
David, scratch that.
Bring it out.
Scratch that itch, mate.
Thank you. No, you're both very kind to let me go on this. Look, I was looking forward to this, and there were so many moments that, having seen the trailers as well... And for some reason, there was one specific detail in the trailers that made me think, ah, this could be something special, is that for once, Batman is wearing eyeliner and that black eye makeup, which we don't see in other films, even the Nolan ones, which go for gritty realism and the actual practicalities of a bat suit. When he takes off the mask, he is just, you know, him, flesh. And I loved the attention to detail in that. And I found that in the film, because there is a lot I admire about this film. I liked the fact that it starts with year two, that it's not an origin story. I like the fact that, yes, the details of the bat suit, and I won't go into certain details to avoid certain spoilers, but at one point there is some sort of base jumpy moment where I thought, ah, I haven't seen that in Batman before. Wonderful. I even liked, because we were talking about Marvel, the fact that the third act isn't a smash bang, you know, wallop, you know, big kind of thing going from the sky, or, you know, yeah. My problem, and this is, I found this film aggressively underwhelming, purely because I think the script is awful. And if I may, and then I'll shut up, because I know I'm going off on my rant, but I love the fact that it went to a detective noir story, and Batman is supposed to be the world's greatest detective, but at no point did I feel like he was particularly being a good detective. My biggest problem is that at the halfway mark of this film, it goes full seven. And it has during the most of the film. It's very dark, it's raining all the time, and then when you get to the Riddler's place, there's all these books and all the thing. And even the Riddler, the fact that, you know, sorry for the spoilers here, you might want to cut this out, I don't know, but the fact that, I don't think it's much of a spoiler, at some point he lets himself be caught, much like John Doe in Seven, and he has a master plan. But the thing is that all of this is fine, but if you are going to reference an ape David Fincher so much, you better come correct. And you better have a clever enough script, because David Fincher's scripts, not all necessarily by him, are very intelligent. I'm not a huge fanboy of his, but at the same time, when you have Seven, there is a master plan. Your lead antagonist is five steps ahead. I did not feel that with the Riddler. I thought the riddles themselves were actually aggressively stupid. Oh my God, a penguin has wings. Do you know what else has wings? A falcon. It's just like, you morons. This isn't detecting, this is listing foul. And but the thing is also, I have to admit, and this is where Matt Reeves really lost me, is I don't think it's a particularly well-filmed film, to the extent so many of the times I couldn't quite get the geography of it, especially in that car chase. I was just like, what is going on? And maybe that was the point, to have that disorientating kind of where it's pissing rain and stuff like that. But I thought it was a very poorly shot car chase. And beyond that, I'm really sick of this cinematic shorthand that if you're going to make things gothic, if you're going to make things serious and emo and stuff like that, it needs to be dark and raining. I'm sorry, it's what Zack Snyder was doing with his DC stuff, if it's always constantly dark and raining. That, I don't know, I found myself squinting a lot in this film, just going, where are we? What's going on? And again, and this is where I stop, and I promise I will stop. There's so much I love about this film. I think the casting is phenomenal. I think that bloody hell, I mean, Colin Farrell, that's how you do prosthetics and makeup. Bravo. I mean, all plaudits there. I think Paul Dano is a wonderful Riddler. I think they did very well with Catwoman and Zoe Kravitz as well. I think they had all the elements. R-Bats, wonderful. I think he's back to Edward Cullen mode in this, but it works. Yeah. I like the fact that he is essentially a vampire, and it works very, very well in that kind of gothic mansion. But the problem with this film is that I know it's a stupid thing to say, because you don't necessarily go to Batman film for it to be particularly clever or intelligent or anything like that, but I have the sneaking suspicion that this is a film that thinks it's cleverer than it is. And I wanted, and I really wanted, especially with an antagonist like the Riddler, I wanted so much to have a twist or a spin, or just going, oh shit, I hadn't thought of that. I've been led on, you know, on the merry trail by the Riddler, and the overall end game is, and the stakes are good, but I found the stakes pretty much non-existent, and the whole thing just ended up as a bit of an overblown mess.
I can't disagree with what you're saying, like in this last sentence, like because I still love the movie.
Okay.
But what you're saying about the ending, and this could be a whole other conversation, but what you're saying about the ending is right, in that by the end I'm like, okay, there's nothing really clever going on. The twist with, not to give it away, but the twist with his parents is like, meh.
Yeah.
And it doesn't amount to much. Yeah. But what I think upon, I've seen it three times now, what I think each time I see it more, what I really get from it is that he's going for the Chinatown-esque aspect of ultimately the problem with Gotham is that everyone is corrupt.
Yes.
And that his end conclusion here isn't just, oh, Batman saves the day by doing this and that. His end conclusion here is, well, shit, Gotham is really fucked up. Mm. And everyone involved in it, including Batman, by the end, Batman's realization is he's contributing to the bad part of Gotham. Yeah. And he needs to deal with that. And I think that is, to me, the real clever core of what the movie is because the cleverness is not the Marvel-esque plotting of he needs to fight some giant thing at the end.
It's
him coming to the realization of Batman being problematic.
Yes.
And where is his place in Gotham? What is the line to cross or not? And Catwoman kind of almost pushes him over that line and doesn't. And him coming to the realization at the end that he is not really saving Gotham. And that is, to me, the ultimate core of what Batman is his connection to Gotham. Like, whether or not that is something they haven't done in every other movie past, and of course that's all Batman is, like, even Catwoman jokes that he's taken by Gotham and like that's all it is, and yes, we've seen that all so many times. It doesn't take away from the fact that the film is still engaging in the way it deals with the grime of Gotham to me, and especially with the villains, because I love that Penguin isn't really Penguin yet. He's just Oz, and they're leading him up to something, but he's also there with Totoro's Falcone character, and there is more going on. Oh, and then there is the Riddler, who none of them seem to know, who is also contributing to this stuff, and there's a lot. It actually kind of reminded me a little bit on my recent viewing of Watchmen, Zack Snyder's Watchmen, where it deals with this grittiness of, like, what is the point of mass vigilantes? Are they actually helping the world get better or not? And we're going to ask this question in a very realistic way and not a fanciful Marvel superhero way. And I like that he gets into that. Of course, I don't think it's, like, Watchmen level brilliant, but I think it's very interesting in the way Matt Reeves built a Hollywood blockbuster around this deep, dark question of whether or not there is any actual positive benefit to a mass vigilante in Gotham. And even what I also love about Riddler is that for most of the movie, Riddler's actually taking out the bad people. Yeah, and I felt like for half of it, Batman's kind of like, okay, I'm kind of with you, but I'm kind of not, you know?
Here's one of the things, and I'm sorry, because one of the scenes, and again, I'm not sure, Mark, if this will make it in, because it's not necessarily a spoiler, but there is a scene that with the Riddler and Batman sharing a scene towards the end of the film. Mm. Yeah. And I love that because it's poor Dano having the time of his life. Yeah. And I was reminded enormously of his role in Prisoners in that. And I thought he was such canny casting for that character. But again, I wanted his plot and his whole journey to be a bit more intelligent, to be a bit more clever. But beyond that, exactly as you said, Alex, I think they missed a trick. And I know this is the most annoying thing that film critics often do, and I found myself guilty of this, is just like trying to rewrite a film in the way that you would have enjoyed it more. It's just like, no, I mean, you know, you can have your own versions of things. But it was so teased that I thought that would have made it a better film for me. That because they are both sides of the same coin, you're right, the Riddler is taking out people that should really be taken out by Batman as well. And he is doing a good work. And at one point, he says the name Bruce Wayne, as though he knows that Batman is. And at one point, I thought also, because the camera was filming their interaction in that scene, that the Riddler may have essentially started to gaslight Gotham, of making people realise, oh, the Batman was in on it the whole time.
That was his plan.
Yeah, that essentially that we are going to make the world believe that it wasn't just me doing all of this. And that would have been clever for me. That would have been a very interesting avenue to go down.
Because they were like one step away from doing
exactly. And that's what frustrated me a little bit. But it didn't necessarily have to do that. But at the same time, if what you're going to do instead is, oh, by the way, remember that first murder weapon that I used? If you take the carpet down in my place, you'll realise that my thing is to flood Gotham. And I'm sorry, and Mark, we were mentioning this before the podcast, at no point during that film is it mentioned that Gotham has the structural integrity of a Cocoa Pop and is the US version of Venice.
Yeah, so it's implied, but not really.
Right, but there is no point in which, like, okay, there are seven vans with seven explosions. I do not believe that you know, you need to do more. This feels like a cop-out. And this whole sudden flooding...
It was a weird ending, but I don't want to...
I think it's a film... Well, first off, when I first came out of the film, I thought it was 2 hours of a great film, and the third hour was messy at best. in hindsight, and I am looking forward to the second screening, my memory of it is improving, my opinion of it is improving. And the main reason is the parallels with The Dark Knight. Because, like The Dark Knight, the red line that pulls you through the entire movie is the acting masterclass of Paul Dano. Because, again, similar to Heath Ledger's Joker in The Dark Knight, he's an outsider, he's an unknown. He's operating off the radar compared to everybody else. And his performance is genuinely creepy. It's genuinely unnerving. And say what you like about the script, and we can discuss the merits of having to be faithful to graphic novels versus totally rewriting stories and stuff for cinema audiences. In a way, Dano's performance, like Heath Ledger's, just takes the raw materials and runs with it. It's the acting that pulls me through. I am invested in the Riddler. I'm invested in why is he doing this. To be blunt, Batman is a bystander in this movie, certainly for the first couple of hours. We learn about him in pieces, which is actually interesting, because again, it's not this thing of a bad guy showing up who seems to have bigger guns or better toys than Batman, and there's a duel for supremacy and Gotham is the prize, and we've seen that in so many Batman films. I like the fact that it set itself up to be a detective story, and that as the audience we're learning information at the same time that Gordon and Batman are learning information. Where it kind of came apart for me was at the end, when that sense of mystery and the explosions and the bit with the football stadium seems to hop back to the Nolan's third Batman movie.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, okay. So it's intriguing, because normally when you watch trailers for these kind of films, they'll usually have the money shots in the trailer, and it's to sort of say there's going to be some acting, there's going to be some character development, and then at the end there is a big explosion of some shape or form where something big falls down, gets blown up, whatever. This film doesn't do that. This film is all totally rides on suspension of information, totally relies upon mystery. Now, you were underserved by the mystery.
Very much so, yeah.
Which is fair enough. There are other people, I'm sure, who will watch this film who just want to see Batman beat people up and don't even care about that story. Mm. Having watched Matt Reeves's Planet of the Apes movies, I was kind of curious to see, I hate to say, kind of like on an intelligence level, where this film would come in, because I thought the Apes movies were very, very sensitively handled, yeah, given the fact that it was essentially, that the source material was far more popcorn in its kind of like, in its history. And so I was kind of curious as to how reverent this film was going to be. And I think if there is a triumph, if there is a success with this movie, I actually think that the film has a look, an approach, and an execution that is distinct from Nolan, distinct from Tim Burton. And that was the big question mark for me, was like, how much am I going to see a slightly more this Chris Nolan, or am I going to see a slightly more this Tim Burton? Because it's the same material, it's the same character. And I actually really enjoyed the whole kind of gothic overtones. I mean, it was a bit silly, you know, literally walking to every building, and the interior looks like a church.
Yeah, a gothic cathedral, yeah.
Let me take you to my broom cupboard, which has vaulted ceilings. Yeah. But it's, you kind of run with it. And okay. I think it's something that, again, that third act I'm always going to have a slight problem with, because to be honest, the first two acts are great. It's building up mystery, 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 mystery. We get Paul Dano. We get a reveal and a tease. And frankly, the movie should stop there. Because after that point, we're into the business of building bridges for potential sequels. And frankly, that's not necessary.
I agree with you about the sequel baiting. I didn't necessarily think that that was a negative for me, because I can't deny by that point I was, as you said, so underserved by the central mystery.
The problem was the film just fizzles out.
Yeah, a little bit. And I can't deny this whole, this is where I agree with Alex, with regards to the musings on vigilantism, with regards to how Batman is evolving, and this is what I like about it. If you see him in year two of his career, he hasn't figured out what he wants to do and how he wants to behave. That I am completely on board with. I just think there is something of a missed opportunity with this one. That's it. And as much as I agree with you that I was very, very happy to see it, you know, not necessarily riding on Nolan's coattails. But when you do see it again, just look at it and tell me this isn't a love letter to Fincher. And
it is, but that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing, but this is the problem. If you're going
rather
to make
that
a love,
Zack Snyder, come on.
Right. But if you are going to make a love letter to Fincher, please, please, please make sure that there is something going on there, that you're not just kind of aping. And that was my problem with it, is I wanted to see Seven again. I wanted to see Zodiac again after that film, and I'm in no hurry to watch it again.
I think the door's open if he does another film where potentially he could do that.
Maybe, and if they do make a second film, and I'm pretty sure they probably will, because it seems to be doing rather well, and with regards to these films, they all have to sign up for three-picture deals. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Matt Reeves doing it, or at least, you know, getting some of the cast back, and I'd be thrilled. Because, like I said, I think if the one main positive I can say about The Batman is a casting master coup. They've really cast the right people for the right roles. I just wish I'd felt more with that. But if they do go back, and if the Riddler does come back in the second one, I'd be thrilled as well, because I wanted more of Dano. I really wanted to spend more time with him.
My guess is that he's going to be a pawn of Joker, based on their scene at the end. Like, Joker's going to use Riddler, yes, and we're going to see some of him in that next one being used, and then there's going to be some sort of reveal where he was just a pawn for Joker to do some other big plot, which, yes, is cool, because that's what Joker's that's good at. Like, yeah.
But do we suspect that there is an R-rated cut out there? Because there's this kind of... story's kind of going out where the studios are saying to filmmakers, make it R, and then they dial it back to PG-13,
yeah,
for audiences.
So, I don't think Reeves is that kind of person, though. Everything he's made has been pretty squarely PG-13. Like, he's not... I think he knows that violence is necessary in the realism of the Batman, but he's not the kind of person that would go, like, heavy on the gore.
Yeah, but again, I didn't need gore. That's not that. I wanted more tension. I wanted something a bit creepy. I wanted, again, because it fucking tips its hat so much to Seven, I wanted a little bit more of that noir-esque kind of unease that there was in that. Oh, since we're still on the Batman, before we move on to something else, I need to ask you about the score, specifically about the use of Something in the Way by Nirvana. But I'm sorry, if you're going to include Nirvana, fine. Just do it once, don't do it twice.
Thank you, and thank you.
You don't need it twice, especially not playing over towards the end. Why on earth, just pick another song, or don't for the love of God, you know, have him reading off his, you know, diary entry journal, I need to be better, something in the way, but no, seriously, just go to your room.
I've heard some laboured scores in my time, and this took a song that I like, and by the end, I was grating my teeth.
Okay, good, good, Mark, good.
Just to explain how that... I want to be constructive here.
As opposed to the ranting monstrosity on the other side of this table. Hello!
If they had played the song at the end and the whole of the score was the clue that we were building up to that song reveal, I would have been fine with it. But the fact that we had it at the beginning as a tone setter, and then at the end, no, sorry. And given the fact that it's such a long movie, 2 hours 50 minutes of half played Nirvana.
Yeah.
No, that just did me in.
Yeah, and just
Shrug emoji.
No, fair enough. But okay, do you know what? I am glad we've had this conversation, because quite frankly, Alex, I will go back and rewatch it. Because I will go back and I'll give some time, and I will go back within the optic of what you were saying, and saying very eloquently about, you know, the vigilanteism and so on and so forth.
That's what each time I rewatch it, that's what I saw more and more. Okay. I was like, I don't care about the mystery of anything. I don't care about the noir anymore. I'm trying to understand, like, what is really going on in here, and that's what I felt
Well, fair enough. But by that same token, if you do go see it again, and Mark, I know you will, just keep Fincher in your mind and just kind of go...
He's always in my mind.
Well, I mean, you know, when do I not think about him? But at the same time, just that it is really, at some points, just plagiarizing Seven. Like certain scenes, but there's also two lines of dialogue, which I won't reveal if you do, which are literally plagiarized from John Doe.
Again, I was on board with the gothic overtones.
Oh, totally, yeah.
But in terms of toffees and boiled sweets and Oscar nominations,
okay,
having run the gamut of most of what 2022's had to offer us, irrespective of what the Academy members may have thought or what they may have nominated, mm-hmm. What would your choices be, gentlemen?
I think what's interesting, if I want to jump in with Best Picture, is that I had my what I expected to win based off of the buzz, and then it has all changed last week, because now, and I would preface this by saying I'd be happy with this because I like the film a lot. If Coda wins, I'd be fine with it. And they're saying that it has the right buzz, and they're saying it's also based on preferential ballot.
Okay. Actor in a leading role. So we have Javier Bardem for being the Ricardos, Benedict Cumberbatch for Power of the Dog, Andrew Garfield, Tick Tick Boom, Will Smith, King Richard, and Denzel Washington in The Tragedy of Macbeth. Solid nominations, gentlemen. Mark, who should win in your opinion?
Denzel Washington.
Who will win in your opinion?
Oh dear God. I'd like to say Denzel.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he has a chance.
I think he has a decent chance.
The Academy generally loves him in general.
I think it would be a good... Don't get me wrong, he's not, as far as I'm aware, he's not shutting up shop, and I think there is another Equalizer movie being gassed as we speak, which I actually loved a bit.
Okay.
Denzel.
Who should have been a contender?
And just as we were about to answer that question, we got swamped. Drowned out by a coachload of thirsty tourists, our venue quickly became a riot of pots, pans, and loud hysterical chatter. So there you go. Such are the perils of recording in a working cafe. Who would have got our nominations? Well, we'll be doing a post-Oscar podcast very soon, where we'll be answering that and many other questions, together with our congratulations and commiserations to those with or without statuettes. In the meantime, if you enjoyed this roundtable podcast, please consider signing up for some more, including our instant movie reviews, which drop the very moment every new movie is released. So until then, please keep safe, and we look forward to seeing you on the next No Spoiler Reviews podcast. All the best. Bye.